Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent challenge to share with you. This podcast is brought to you by the Ministry of Premier Insight. And on June 30th, we come to the end of our financial year. The challenge we face is there is a final funding gap of $65,000 that must be closed by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help meet this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, welcome along to the program. I'm Justin Briley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored, and back after a short interruption for our Together Now appeal last week, and two fantastic guests to bring you in just a moment's time. I'll be explaining who they are and the topic in a moment. If you're interested in what's happening later on today, well, do join me between 4 and 5 as I'm joined by Paula Gooder on The Profile. Paula Gooder appeared here on Unbelievable a few weeks ago, and I'm going to be doing an in-depth conversation with her between 4 and 5 about her life and faith, and particularly looking ahead to what she'll be saying at Spring Harvest this year. I'm at Spring Harvest as well. It'd be great to see you if you're an Unbelievable listener. I'll be at Minehead week 3 doing some talks on apologetics and the big questions, that kind of thing. So if you are a show listener and you happen to be pitching up to Spring Harvest this year, then do come and say hi to me at the big question seminars. If you still have your diary open, not too late to actually get along to Spring Harvest on any of the weeks at Minehead and Skegness, where there are these big question seminars going on in every week with some great speakers, including Tom Price and Tanya Walker, Krish Kandaya and others. So lots to look out for on that front. If you want to find out more about Unbelievable and the resources we have to offer, some of the videos and various other bits and pieces you can find, including, of course, the link to the latest show, download via podcast and everything else, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the place to go. You can find last week's show. A lot of feedback coming in on that. That was a special podcast-only edition with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, talking about evangelism, but also to the week previous to that, when we took a number of sceptical calls with a team of apologists answering the questions. So we'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme, and I hope you do enjoy today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Welcome along to today's programme, and today we're asking, have we been misreading the Adam and Eve story? My special guests today on the programme are John Walton, Professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College in Illinois. His most recent book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, explores the ancient Near Eastern context of Genesis chapters 2 and 3 and promises space for a faithful reading of Scripture, along with full engagement with science for a new way forward in the human origins debate. To sort of sum it up, effectively, Adam and Eve are an archetype for all humanity, not simply the first human beings. We'll hear how he develops that in the course of today's programme. And in discussion with John today is Steve Lloyd. He's a speaker for Biblical Creation Ministries. He takes a young earth creation view of Genesis. Steve has studied material sciences and theology at the University of Cambridge, and he pastors a church in Gravesend, Kent. A very warm welcome to the programme, both of you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Great to have you on the programme too. Let's start with you, John, as someone who's new to the programme. Give us a little flavour of what you've been aiming to do over the last several years with these Lost World books. This is effectively the third in the series so far, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And basically the concept of Lost World is that we want to try to recover how they thought about these biblical texts in the ancient world. It works on the realisation that these biblical books are written for us, I fully believe that, but they're not written to us. Mm. And therefore, we have to resist reading them as sort of modern texts with modern science and try to read them as ancient texts.
You are professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College, Illinois, and in that sense, I guess your whole job is kind of helping people to understand the context of the Old Testament. Is Genesis probably the most disputed aspect in that whole area?
It probably is. Lots of the books of the Bible need backgrounds help to try to understand the ancient world, but probably none more than Genesis.
This obviously is an area that divides people sharply, very often doctrinally. It may not be quite as severe here in the UK, but how do you sort of see the ground lying in the US particularly in terms of those who are in one camp, the young earth creation camp, for instance, and an old, you've also got your old earth creationists, you've got your theistic evolutionists. What kind of a landscape do you see, and is it a good or a bad thing in a sense for the Christian church?
Well, all of this really is quite controversial here in the States. Lots of people want to read the text well and carefully, and different people are influenced in different ways by scientific discovery and scientific theories. And that interface of how to take account of science and likewise how to be faithful to Scripture leads different people to come to very different conclusions. The result is that for many people, especially those on the extreme ends, they view this as a war. Mm. There's a warfare going on. You have to choose the Bible or science. You can't have them both. At the same time, there are many sort of in the middle that are saying, no, it's really not like that, and that the differences can be adjudicated as we look very carefully at both science and the Bible.
What kind of reaction have you had to the book in terms of, have people found it helpful in helping them to bring the two together in some way?
I get a lot of emails from people who have been very much helped by this. People who say they were on the brink of losing their faith, or they couldn't figure out how to make it all work, and that that my books have really helped them out, and that's really quite gratifying. I get those in the emails. On the blogs, of course, you read other opinions. And so you read those who are very angry, those who are accusing me of all sorts of motivations, and they don't know me, and they don't know what's driving me.
If you don't mind me asking, what view did you grow up with? Has your view changed, in a sense, as you've looked into it?
Yes, it has. I grew up in a young Earth context, and really well into the 90s, I would have considered myself young Earth. Although I confess I would have described myself as an uncomfortable young Earth person, meaning that I didn't see any other way to read the text faithfully, but I was uncomfortable with the conclusions that were drawn. But I'm a person who's committed to the text, and it wasn't until I realized that perhaps faithful reading of the text might go a different direction if we take the ancient world background seriously that I started putting things together differently.
Well, it's great to have you on the conversation today, John, and look forward to digging into this. My other guest on the program today is Steve Lloyd of Biblical Creation Ministries. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
You've been on a couple of times over the years, always in the context of debating with Christians of other kinds, old Earth, young Earth, Adam and Eve, Genesis, and so on. You are a young Earth creationist. Now, probably they come in different flavors, I'm sure. How do you see a kind of similar battle going on, especially in the States, that we've heard from John?
There certainly is a battle going on. I mean, I slightly am unhappy with the term of being called a young Earth creationist. Not that I do believe in a young Earth, and I'm a creationist in that sense, but I think it can tend to have a whole lot of baggage with it that perhaps doesn't express quite where I'm coming from. I'm very concerned to think through this whole topic very theologically, and to me it's not just about how we interpret Genesis 1 and 2, it's about how we fit the whole story of the Bible together. Fundamentally, the key question is, why did Jesus die? To me, that is the central question in the origins debate. Because it's all about, where did physical death come from? So in terms of how the debate plays out in Britain, there's a lot of ignorance in what is done. There are a lot of bad arguments that are sometimes used by people from my camp. But I think it is a topic that we can't avoid, and it is a topic that's very important, because to me it does concern how we understand the gospel, how we understand the nature of God. So we can't avoid this debate. To me, it matters an awful lot, but often it's just not understood in that way.
I mean, you've got a background in science. Hmm. did you take a lot of flack from your scientific peers about your views about the Earth, or did you just not tell them? It's the other option, I suppose, or what?
Well, in the particular field I was working in, this wasn't really an issue that would come up. It was not an issue that was a concern. With different conversations I had with fellow students and other academics and things at the time, yes, this did come up occasionally, and yes, people would find my views strange in certain ways. But that's actually true of an awful lot of what we believe as Christians.
We're going to get into the discussion today and be interested to hear what you make of this as well. If you're listening and you'd like to contribute in some way, why not email me and let me know? unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Twitter is at unbelievablejb. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you want to leave me a message that way. Be also interested to hear from you via the webpage. You can now leave comments underneath today's programme, and you can of course find links there to John's book and to Steve and some other helpful things as well. So that's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Perhaps a good thing to do at this point, John, would be to get you to just briefly explain the central thesis of this book, because what you're proposing is not young earth creationism. I don't think it's really old earth creationism either, if we wanted to go down that road. What is it that you're actually setting out in the lost world of Adam and Eve?
Thanks, Justin. I'm trying to deal with the biblical text. In other words, I'm not trying to promote one scientific view or another. I am interested in figuring out which scientific views can be accommodated by the biblical text. So I'm not a science person, and I really don't argue for evolution or against evolution, for an age of the earth or against an age of the earth. I'm just trying to find out what claims the Bible makes. Mm-hmm. I'm a text analyst in the end, and I want to know what claims the Bible makes, because the nature of those claims will tell us what proposals from science we could feasibly find acceptable or not, whether we like the science or not. And so that's really what I'm trying to go for. And of course, as I analyze the text, I'm interested, first of all, in Genesis, the Hebrew words, the Hebrew ideas, and what's involved with them, but also to see that in the context of the ancient Near East, because the Israelites are located. They're situated in that culture, in that time, and that's reflected in many, many ways, some very subtle, some overt. When I look at the story of Adam and Eve, there are several issues that are typically bundled together that I want to unbundle. That is, the idea of biological material origins is often talked about in connection with the historicity of Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. and with the nature of the image of God, and with the origins of sin. Now, those are four very, very important topics, and they often kind of are bundled together and hang together. And I'm not convinced that they have to be bundled together. So I like to try to deal with them individually. That is, I particularly believe in an Adam and Eve who were real people in a real past. Mm-hmm. I believe that it's actions that they took that initiated sin and that is responsible for sin in the world. I believe that the image of God is something that distinguishes us from other creatures. But I'm not convinced that any of that gives us a basis for understanding the biological material origins of the human species. And so that's where I'm drawing these differences, because in the ancient world, they really didn't care about the biological origins of the human species. Mm-hmm. That's not even an issue on the table. So when I look into the what I call the forming accounts, and just for short, I call it dust and rib, the forming accounts in Genesis 2, I ask the question, are they telling us things that are true only of Adam and Eve, or are they telling us things that are true of all of us? Mm-hmm. If it's only true of Adam and Eve, then you've got a material formation for them that is different than the material formation for any of us. But if they are archetypes, then what the text is doing is saying, you know, Adam's from dust, and in fact, we're all from dust. God creates each one of us from dust. Eve is from the side of man. And in fact, all womankind is from the side of all mankind. That's the nature of humanity. So that's where I'm going when I talk about treating those forming accounts archetypally, that they're saying things that are true of all of us. As a result, they don't say anything about biological material human origins, and therefore, if the science has something different that makes sense, that wouldn't be a problem. The Bible's not claiming something different.
And in that sense, would it be fair to say that you treat Genesis 2 and 3 in a sort of more figurative way, so that, and that this is the way that those who first wrote it down would also have been treating it? Would it be the way Jesus would have read those chapters as well?
You know, I don't know if I would want to call archetypal figurative.
Okay.
I think that every time Paul deals with Adam and Eve, he treats them as archetypes. I don't know if that's figurative, because it's not like he doesn't think they're real people, and it's not like I don't think they're real people. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there's something larger than the individual. And in that sense, the archetypal view is not somehow just metaphorical or figurative or symbolic. There's something real going on here. So Jesus likewise treats them as archetypal. That doesn't suggest that he didn't think they were real people. I believe that he did. I believe Paul did, and I do as well.
And so when you get to some of the other details of the story, there is a garden, there's a snake, there's, you know, God brings all the animals to Adam for him to name, and so on. How does that sort of play into this archetypal view that you have of the Adam and Eve story?
Well, again, I pretty much restrict the archetypal to places in the text where I can tell that they're talking about all of us. That's the difference between an archetypal and an individual. So when I look at the garden, we're not all put in the garden. Adam and Eve are put in the garden. Mm-hmm. We didn't all interact with the snake. Adam and Eve interacted with the snake. So those are places where you're dealing with these individuals who have a particular role in the text, both literarily and as characters. They have a role in the text, and I want to understand what that is. And it's a role that all of us don't have. So again, we have to judge it on a point-by-point basis, where the text is treating them archetypally and where it's treating them individually.
Mm. And so how much kind of, I guess what I'm trying to get to is how much do you see that whole setting in which they're put, the talking snake, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, mm-hmm. and so on, as if you like something that actually happened, you know, a physical place where they were, and we're hearing an actual story that happened to two people, and how much is it, I guess, in some sense, as I say, figurative or metaphorical or whatever?
Well, I think there's a reality foundation to it, but it's tough for us to unpack that, because they wouldn't have drawn those distinctions in the same ways that we do. The garden is typical as a place that adjoined sacred space in the ancient world. So, of course, we've got sacred space, that's Eden. We've got a garden that's adjoining it. By the way, I do distinguish between Eden, which is where God's presence is, and the garden, which is adjoining Eden. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so that's a typical way that sacred space was in the ancient world. The serpent, I don't think they would have said, "Oh, this is Satan." Nobody in the Old Testament gives any recognition to that. The serpent would have likely been considered a chaos creature, which is a different sort of category altogether. The trees, certainly they have a metaphorical element to them, but let me explain that. That is, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that's a wisdom tree. The wisdom tree, therefore, stands for wisdom, and that wisdom is not inherent in the tree itself. Wisdom comes from God. And therefore, the tree represents that which only God can give. Now, if he decides to vest that in a physical material tree, that's his business. But the fact is, the real issue here is that these trees represent things that are find their source in God, whether that's wisdom or whether that's life. These are things that God gives. So in that sense, they may be literal. Even if they are literal, they are certainly metaphorical, because they're representing the gifts of God.
And in a sense, what we should be interested in is what they were interested in when they wrote it down, which is the things these represent, rather than being very concerned with the material origins of these and so on. Really interesting. Thank you, John. I think you've spelled it out very helpfully for us there, and we needed to do that at the outset. So, Steve, okay, you've had a chance to read the book, and thank you for doing that. What's just some general observations about it, and what are your key criticisms of the way that John treats the Genesis story?
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to come back to some of the things that John raised in particular later, but in general terms, there's actually a lot of what John says that I can affirm. I'm quite happy that Genesis is an ancient text, that it doesn't talk about modern science. I'm happy actually with the emphasis on the sort of functional origins. I think that is actually very obvious. I'm also happy with ideas of temple and all that sort of thing in the text. I just don't see that any of that has got anything to do with countering the overall position I'm coming from. I have more of an issue with what John is denying, really, rather than what he's affirming. Mm. And let me maybe just take this in two portions. First of all, the whole issue of ancient Near East literature and John's methodology there. The ancient Near East is a big place, and it also has a long history. So there's a huge gap between saying that a certain people group somewhere in the ancient Near East at a certain point in time thought a certain way about creation, and saying that that was how Israelites thought about that at the particular time that Genesis was written. It's a bit like saying that to understand Shakespeare properly, we need to know all about 10th century Russian literature. It's in the same continent. It was written several centuries before. Somehow that shaped Shakespeare. I don't think that makes sense. And I think you've got to make there's a lot of methodological work to do to show that actually there is a dependence on between the ancient Near East stuff and what is going on in Israel. But also, I have a problem with the sort of disjunctions John brings there. The way he is saying that it's only about functional origins, not about material origins. That's a very strange thing to say. For a start, John 1:3 talks about Jesus being the creator of all things. That's alluding to Genesis 1. And also, Israelites were very concerned about material origins. Think of all the genealogies. They were worried about where they had physically come from. And it's not just me that has a problem here. I've actually taken the liberty of contacting a few ancient Near East scholars about this. And if John's work really was some sort of groundbreaking insight, I think other scholars would have noticed and would have picked up on it. Whereas what I found is actually very little awareness of what of John's thesis, and where there was some awareness, some disagreement. For example, Jack Sasson of Vanderbilt University said, what you can't do is make this either-or distinction and exclude material origins. And even friends of John, like Dennis Lamoureux, evangelical scholars like that, actually disagree strongly with John's position on this. So I'm not sure there's a strong scholarly basis from which to start questioning a whole load of things about Genesis that mean we're rewriting the theology. And that's the sort of the second set of issues I've got.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. And I don't know what order you want to take those in, John. But firstly, is what was going on generally in the ancient Near East as, is it having as much an effect as you claim on the way that we should read the way that the ancient Israelites told their story?
Well, certainly Steve is correct. The ancient Near East is not monolithic. Babylonians did not think the same as Egyptians, and even a Babylonian like Hammurabi did not think the same as a Babylonian like Nebuchadnezzar over a millennium later. So those are things that we have to be very cautious about. But remember, I'm not trying to suggest that the Genesis account is dependent on ancient Near Eastern accounts. What I'm trying to do is say, here's what I see in Genesis, based on independent analysis of the text. Now, the next question is that something that I find has some commonality in ancient Near Eastern texts? Maybe here or there, maybe Egyptian, maybe Babylonian. Are these ideas things that I find there? Mm. So that's the first thing that I'm interested in. Is there that kind of thinking that can be identified there? Secondly, of course, there are some things that do spread pretty well across the ancient Near East, and the functional interest is precisely that kind of thing. That is, we find it in early Sumerian works, Enkian world order, and we find it as late as Papyrus Insinger, Egyptian Hellenistic period. So, and you can find it all other places around. So this concept that functions are more important to them than materiality can be documented throughout the ancient Near East across time and space.
But just for those who are maybe haven't quite caught on to this issue of functionality and function, just explain again, John, that's what you're saying there is that Genesis in the story it tells is more concerned with the functions, i.e. the roles, I suppose, that the different characters in the story play than the material origin of those characters, if you like. Is that what we're saying? So as you say,
the best word to deal with it is order. Mm. That is, that the biblical text, along with everything else in the ancient Near East, is interested in the ordering of the world, not in the material manufacture of objects in the world. Now, again, I would certainly say that the Israelites would have believed that God did indeed create the material cosmos, just as John 1 expresses and just as we believe. But when you give an origin story, you have to choose what you're going to talk about the origins of. And I suggest that the focus is on the order and the functions that contribute to order, rather than to the material objects themselves.
Well, let's give you a chance as well to respond to the second issue that before we lose it as well, that Steve brought up there, which is he's done some research and he doesn't see much agreement with you from other ancient Near Eastern experts. What do you say to that, John?
Well, I mean, I can reply to the ones he mentioned. Jack Sasson, of course, is an ancient Near Eastern expert and a very good one. But even ancient Near East folks see this a little bit differently. If you ask Jack Sasson about the Babylonian account, whether there was some interest, more interest in order and function, I think he would absolutely agree. If he has a different opinion of the Bible, that's fine. I don't know what his evidence would be. Dennis Lamro is not...
Yeah. Sorry, I was just going to say,
not trained in the ancient Near East, and sure, we have some disagreements, but we also have a lot of agreements.
Yeah, I think Jack Sasson's point was that you can't exclude the idea of an interest in material origins. And I think, in a way, you've been saying, yes, there's an emphasis on functionality, which I accept. And I think that's actually there in Genesis. The problem is when you're saying it's got nothing to say on material origins. That is the issue people have, I think, with what you're saying.
And I would be interested in figuring out exactly how he supported that there is a material aspect. Furthermore, of course, both Jack Sasson and Dennis Lamoureux believe that Genesis is mythology. That puts them in a totally different world of discourse from what I'm involved in. So that makes it difficult. There are plenty of ancient Near Eastern scholars who would find agreement with me. So to pick out a couple that don't, well, that's not hard to do. I expect there are some.
Well, to be fair, all the ones I dealt with, I think, had an issue. But anyway.
Well, let's come back to that, because we are just out of time in this first part of the programme. Time has flown, as it always does. And we'll come back into this. We're talking about Adam and Eve today. Have we been misreading the Adam and Eve story? In his most recent book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, John Walton says that actually we need to rethink the way we approach that story. Perhaps Adam and Eve are, in fact, an archetype for all humanity, not just the first human beings. We need to think about their function, their role, rather than necessarily them being, if you like, a scientific explanation of where we came from and so on. Well, Steve Lloyd from Biblical Creation Ministries is in conversation with John on this today. We hope you're enjoying it, and come back again in a moment's time for part two.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In our Easter edition, find out why science is shedding new light on the death and resurrection of Jesus as we investigate the Turin Shroud and an autopsy of the crucifixion. Plus, meditation isn't just for Buddhists. Discover why Christians are getting into mindfulness. And we respond to Stephen Fry getting angry with God. All that plus news, reviews and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme here on Unbelievable. We aim to help you think through your faith if you're a Christian, and to think through the Christian faith altogether if you're a sceptic. But today it's very much a Christian-Christian interaction as we look at two people with different theological points of view on the Adam and Eve story. John Walton is my guest by phone. He's Professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College, Illinois. And his most recent book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, looks at the ancient Near Eastern context of Genesis 2 and 3. And it has some really interesting things to say about that. He has been criticised by young earth creationists, certainly, who believe that he's not being true to the text. But he says, no, as far as he's concerned, he's reading the text for what it is. And he sees this pattern emerge, this theme that Adam and Eve are archetypes for all humanity. That's how they would have been understood by the people who wrote them down. They weren't trying to write, in that sense, a science textbook. Well, at that level, Steve Lloyd agrees with him, but wonders whether he's maybe thrown too much out, and that the Adam and Eve story can still be read as a story about origins as well as functionality, as we've been talking about. Steve's here from Biblical Creation Ministries joining me in the studio. If you want to respond to anything you hear on today's programme, be delighted to hear from you via email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, you can leave comments as well underneath today's show at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And I'll make sure to leave links there as well to both John and Steve, where you can find out more about them and what they've written. Steve, coming back to you then for your theological response. We've said from the outset today we're not arguing the science so much today. That's a different kind of conversation. But for you, that what's at stake here is Christian theology when it comes to how we interpret the Adam and Eve story. Do you want to just spell that out for us a bit and see what John has to say?
Yeah, the reason I've been questioning the sort of scholarly basis for this sort of emphasis on ancient Near East literature is because of the theological fallout that comes from this. You know, do we really need to rethink our theology on the basis of that ancient Near East understanding? I mean, to me, that the key problem with John's work is summarised actually in what he's got in chapter 18. That the title for that chapter is "Jesus is the keystone of God's plan to resolve disorder and perfect order." Now, I actually shared this with my kids last night. I'm sure John will be pleased to know that his book's being talked about with children. And I asked them, well, what do you think he would have talked about in that chapter? And my 11-year-old daughter said, well, the cross. And yet the astonishing thing is there is not one mention of the cross in that chapter. And John is actually being completely consistent in that, because in his scheme, Jesus' death has got nothing to do with sorting out the order of creation, with sorting out a new creation. Because he doesn't see the suffering and the sort of intrinsic evil in creation as something that came from sin. It's always been there, and hence Jesus' death has got nothing to do with how that is sorted out. Now, that's looking at the sort of new creation. If you think back to the original creation, again, there's the problem that John shares with many other people that take similar views, that you have death and suffering, disease in the original creation that God makes. And so you're faced with a very uncomfortable choice. You either have to say things like cancer is very good, or you have to say that God is the source of evil. And neither of those are, I don't think, good starting points in our evangelism. Because if you're saying that that cancer was part of the world that God made very good, you're saying that either God had to say that was very good, or if John is saying, well, no, that wasn't a perfect part of the world, it wasn't how God wanted it in the end, you have to say that God made it with that in place. So God made something that is as horrendous as cancer and disease. And just a third area that causes all sorts of problems is how we understand the relationship of mankind with God and the image of God. Because in the sort of scheme that John has, to be given a relationship with God, a knowledge of God, is actually a terrible curse, because it suddenly brings a responsibility for sin. Because John believes that there were human beings that were engaging in what we would consider sinful behaviour. They were violent, and yet they were not held accountable because they weren't in this relationship with God. And yet when they are brought into this relationship with God, suddenly that is all made accountable. And so that would seem to me to make that something of a curse.
I mean, I suppose we're making a few leaps there in terms of, I guess, making some assumptions about what John does actually believe about the first human pair, or whatever it might be, who and so on. Now, John, obviously, so what Steve's saying is this has massive implications for Christian theology if we don't have a very kind of literal understanding, for want of a better word, of the fall, where you've got a perfectly created world, which is, you know, broken, if you like, by the sin of Adam and Eve? Because obviously, I think from your perspective, you don't hold that that Genesis is telling us exactly that. It's saying that at some point, a human couple were given, if you like, the awareness of God. I could be misinterpreting where you actually stand on this. So just be interested to hear your response there to Steve.
Well, I'm happy to have a chance to, because that is really what the things Steve has said really do misrepresent where I stand and the things that I believe. So I'm happy to have a chance to clear it up. Certainly, the cross is important. The cross resolves sin and death. And so I don't find any difficulty with that. But if I didn't happen to mention the cross, that's not because somehow I don't think that it's important. I think one of the key issues here is that I do not believe that the world was perfectly created. I don't believe the Bible presents it that way. That is, there is a certain level. Steve seems to present as if there's two possibilities. There's good and there's evil. Good and evil are fine terms. I also talk about them in terms of disorder and order. Okay, disorder being sin, morally problematic, order being good, what God has created. Now, he said that I must either therefore think cancer is good or that God is the author of evil. Well, no, because I think there's a third category, and that is non-order is what I call it. Mm-hmm. Non-order is just something that's not been put together yet. It's something that's not intrinsically evil, but it's not yet fully ordered. And the biblical account gives us the idea that there is non-order in the world. It starts with tohu vavohu in Genesis 1-2, formless and void, or however you translate those. And so, therefore, things are being ordered. In the last few days, I've helped my daughter move to a new apartment. Boxes everywhere. That's not evil. That's just non-order. Mm-hmm. And you have to have the things in the boxes, and then you unpack them, and that's order-bringing activity. And so in that sense, I would see lots of the things that plague us in this world as being still vestiges of non-order. They are not evil, so you don't say that God has created evil, but likewise, they're not good. Mm-hmm. A tornado is devastating. It's not good. It's non-order. But it's not evil either. It has no moral or volitional elements connected to it. And so we live in a world where there is still lingering non-order, because God made us in his image to subdue and rule. That is to continue the process of bringing order. Greg Beale's very theological book about the temple and the mission of the church to continue bringing order from non-order. And therefore, this theological concept that we are order-bringing creatures, that's what the image of God gives us, and that's the task that we have. And that's not resolving somehow a residual evil that was always there. It's working with non-order. Mm. And so in that sense, to say that relationship with God is a curse, I tremble at thinking that. I mean, people are saying the same thing to Paul. Well, then the law is a bad thing because that made us aware of sin and now we're accountable. And Paul specifically addresses that in Romans 5. And so I don't think that we can make that kind of statement. So those are a couple of the ways that I would respond to try to clarify I believe.
And before Steve comes back, what is your take on the fall, if you like? And I'd be interested to hear kind of where you do put a literal Adam and Eve in that picture, whether they have some kind of prime responsibility for the existence immorality and the bad choices and so on, and free will that were the consequences.
Through Adam and Eve, real people in a real past, they made choices because they had been given accountability. And therefore, when they acted against what they were told, sin entered the world. The fall is not just an act of disobedience. The fall is not just an act of eating a piece of fruit, although you could say it's both of those things. But most importantly, the fall is they want to be like God. And they want to be like God, not meaning that they want to be omniscient and omnipotent. They want to be like God because they want order, wisdom to flow around them. They want to be the center of their own ordered world. And that's the nature of the fall, and that's the nature of all of us. I see the fall as happening at a specific moment based on an act by Adam and Eve.
But it doesn't. And it's not that, the thing that brings in, if you like, death and cancer and all those other things, because in a sense they are part of the non-ordered world that God is bringing order to at some level.
Correct. But they had a chance. They had a remedy. They were given the tree of life. You wouldn't need to be given a tree of life if you were immortal. They were given the tree of life, which provided a remedy. When they chose to try to order everything around themselves, they lost access to the tree of life. They lost the remedy, and therefore we are all subject to death because of sin, just as Paul says.
Okay.
Well, I'm not quite sure what I've misrepresented, because even what you've just said then, that death was there before Adam and Eve sinned. You've just said that. So, and I think we've got to make a... You've got to be careful with these talking about things as non-order and stuff. I mean, I'm not quite sure what I meant to do as a pastor in explaining to people that when they're suffering different things, that this is sort of part of the non-order of creation. From what you've said, we can put it in these terms. Your God is a God who creates a world with cancer and death in the beginning as what he wants to make and calls it very good. My God creates a world that is perfect without that suffering and death, which does have a role for ordering things. There's work to be done, but that is very different to saying that there are things like brain tumors and death in place from the beginning. And I think this issue of mortality, I don't believe that Adam and Eve were immortal at the beginning in the sense that they had life in themselves. God is the only one who has life in himself. They needed to eat food, presumably because without food they couldn't exist. So it's quite natural to have a tree of life. But that is very different to saying that you have the principle of death in you because you have disease intrinsically within you. And so we've got to be very careful how we're using these terms, death, because I think you're using it in a slightly different way to the way I'm using that term.
I think you've hit exactly the issue, Steve. You and I understand the word good differently. Mm-hmm. You and I understand the word death differently. You and I understand the concept of order differently. Mm-hmm. And that's at the heart of these distinctions. When the Bible describes the original state as being tohu vavohu, my research on those words is that they refer to a situation that is not ordered and therefore not functioning optimally. When God declares that his acts of bringing order in the Genesis 1 are good, he's saying that they are now functioning optimally. They are ordered for human existence. They are ready to serve as sacred space. That's not at all the same thing as saying that it's perfect. Hebrew has other words for perfect, and tov, good, is not one of them. So I would see those distinctions. And again, we have differing opinions of some of those words. I realize that that's at the base of this. I've tried in my book to demonstrate that there's reason to take those words differently than what we traditionally have. But I can understand that you're still kind of working with some of the very traditional definitions.
And in as much as you do believe death obviously existed before the fall, do you at any level believe that physical death has anything to do with the fall of Adam and Eve, you know, as a first sort of perhaps couple with the consciousness of God or whatever it might be? Or when Paul talks about, you know, Christ turning back the curse and so on, is it just about spiritual death at some level or something like that?
No, certainly Christ is giving the remedy that was lost. They lost life that was available through a relationship with God. That was represented in the tree of life. Christ is providing that life now with a relationship that will be available because of his blood, because of his death. That relationship will be available. And so in that sense, exactly, Christ is providing that remedy.
So are you saying that Jesus' death is about sorting out the spiritual issue of our relationship with God, but it's got nothing to do with physical death? Because if so,
But you're saying physical death was already there,
so why does Jesus need to die physically?
Well, I mean, I don't understand why you would think that, the idea that Jesus has conquered death, that we no longer have to die because we have access to him as the source of life, that gives us life and it gives it to us eternally. So I don't see the difficulty there.
But to me, that's splitting up the atonement as being about conquering death for the future. That's what Jesus' death and resurrection were about. They're nothing to do with dealing with sin from the past, only in a spiritual sense.
Atonement theory goes way beyond the book that I wrote and the things that I have to say. I don't see any implications for those issues. Mm. I'm sorry.
I was just saying that I think, but what you are saying though in your book has very big implications for how we do understand things like the atonement.
Well, it may have implications for that, but again, that's not an area that I'm trying to work it out. I'm certainly not trying to undermine or lessen the atonement. That's not my view of things. I know there are different views of the atonement, and of course, as you know, Tom Wright wrote a section in my book, and he's got his own particular views of the atonement, some of which are controversial. But again, that's really not what the book's about, and so we're drifting a little bit far from the discussion.
What did Tom Wright have to say in the book? I'd just be interested in because obviously Tom Wright is primarily a New Testament scholar, and it would be interesting in that sense to get a sense of how he and you therefore believe Jesus Christ sort of thought about Adam and Eve and so on. Because again, I think Steve's going to say that he believes Jesus Christ had, you know, believed in the first created couple, if you like, as Adam and Eve. Presumably, you don't believe that is what Jesus Christ thought about Adam and Eve, however, John.
I can't account for what Jesus thought or didn't think. I can only look at what is reported about what he said. And I take that very seriously, but he really doesn't go into a whole lot of detail in those things. Tom Wright agreed to write in the book because, as you might imagine, being an Old Testament scholar, I was not confident that when I said things about Paul or about Jesus that people would take my word for it. I don't have any credentials, and developing those lines of argumentation is not my area of specialty. So I wanted someone who had New Testament credentials and specialty to do that part, and Tom very graciously agreed to do it.
What was his fundamental sort of the way in which he did spell that out then?
I'm reluctant to try to summarize Tom Wright. People will have to read that chapter on their own. Again, it's beyond my expertise, and I would be afraid that I would mischaracterize him.
Okay, we've talked a bit about the theological implications. For you, I guess, Steve, in the end, what's most important is that it acts as a unity with what we read in the New Testament. And for you feel it sort of chops off somehow the story of Genesis from interacting properly with... I mean, it sounds as though your main concern is the knock-on effect, if you like, that John's thesis has, rather than necessarily what he actually... sort of the way he actually handles the text there in Genesis itself.
I do have some issues with the way he handles the text in Genesis, but in a way that all comes back from the New Testament. My starting point in all of this stuff is really always the New Testament. It doesn't actually, in the first place, depend on how you understand how the early chapters of Genesis are put together. And, you know, the way the New Testament writers understand Adam and Eve, as John agrees, as historical people. And the key thing about it is they're not just historical people, they are people that do things that have an impact upon us today, just as Jesus is a historical person who did things that has an impact upon us today. And the way that the New Testament, I think, understands our relationship with Adam, the whole idea of physical descent is actually something very important. The problem, if you disconnect our relationship with Adam from anything physical, is that it becomes something completely arbitrary, that God decrees that Adam is this head over us. But there's no real basis for that. And I think the New Testament is clear that there is a physical connection between us and Adam. We bear the likeness of the earthly man, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:49. Where does that likeness come from? Well, if we read Genesis 5:3, it comes through physical descent. Seth is born in the likeness of Adam. And that, to me, is a justification for why we are all the image of God. It has come because of our physical descent from Adam. And if we start querying that, we start having real problems with, for example, I'm interested to know where John wants to sort of date Adam, where he would be placed historically. But you could have issues where one group could say we're descended from Adam. Another group, maybe some Aboriginals in Australia, would not be descended from Adam. And you start having, Jesus is someone descended from Adam. Well, is he more a savior of those who are also descended from Adam? In what sense is he the savior of all humanity? So I think there's real problems when you start removing this whole idea of physical descent.
John?
First of all, here we see another very, very clear differential between our viewpoints. I do not start with the New Testament. We can't possibly read the book of Genesis as an ancient text if we're starting with the New Testament. That doesn't mean that I undervalue or undermine the theological content and import of the New Testament. But hermeneutically, that is not my starting point. I want to start with what the author intended to say, because there is authority, in my view of my hermeneutic, in what the author intended to say. I don't consider the image of God to be physical. So I don't think the image of God is passed on to each of us because of physical descent. Certainly there were times in church history when people thought that. But I think that the image of God, as I try to develop it and understand it in the biblical text, is not something that is genetic or material or biological in any sense. It is a task that God gives. God charges us with a task, and we are his images to carry that out. And Jesus, of course, is the image of God, the true and final image of God. So I don't believe that the physical connection is near as important as Steve thinks it is. If God decrees that Adam is the federal head of all of us, that's enough for me. God decrees it. It doesn't have to be supported by a physical or genetic or biological relationship. And so to me, physical descent is not as important. That's that unbundling that I was talking about. Mm. I can understand that some people still believe that's important. I don't think it is, and I don't think any theology hangs on it. My theology is actually fairly conservative. It's just my exegesis that's kind of breaking into new ground.
I mean, I think Steve is interested to know if you had to kind of give an estimate where you would, if you like, speak of Adam and Eve as a physical couple in history emerging, if you like. I'm assuming you believe in some kind of sense that a hominid couple were, if you like, endowed at some point with the knowledge or a relationship with God. And they kind of, so that you do get some kind of a first couple who we can speak of as an Adam and Eve.
If there was only one couple around, then that couple was endowed with the image of God. If there is a whole population around, the whole population was endowed with the image of God. In other words, there's no possibility, in my way of thinking, to say some human beings are in the image of God and others are not, at whatever time period we're dealing with. So in that sense, I don't think the image of God issue is involved in that question. I really can't say where to date Adam and Eve because, of course, science doesn't have any interest or ability to discuss Adam and Eve, and the Bible has no interest in discussing some Neolithic or whatever couple to place them scientifically. So if the Bible's not dealing with the kind of scientific interface that we need, and science is not dealing with the biblical interface we need, I really can't, it would just be wild speculation, and sure. I don't know that I can do that.
Yeah. We're going to take another quick break, and then we'll be back for the final part of today's show. And if you're interested in getting in touch, then do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be interested to hear your views on this as well. Whatever theological perspective you come from on this, and perhaps of no theology whatsoever, be interested to hear your response as to how we should read the Adam and Eve story. John Walton, my guest by telephone, professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College in Illinois, talking about his new book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, in conversation with Steve Lloyd of Biblical Creation Ministries, who takes a young earth creation view of Genesis, and we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Back into the final part of our discussion with my two guests, John Walton and Stephen Lloyd, in just a moment's time. Later on today, between 4 and 5, I'm joined by Paula Gooder. She is a fantastic Bible teacher. She's one of the Bible teachers at this year's Spring Harvest. So you're going to be hearing my conversation with her on her life and faith and ministry. That's between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Also, next week on Unbelievable, it's Holy Saturday. It's the Easter weekend, and I've got something rather special for you. You're going to be hearing on the radio the Shroud, a documentary I produced last year, actually, on the Turin Shroud and whether it could be the burial cloth of Christ and even evidence for the resurrection of Christ. Well, we'll be re-airing that between 2 and 2.30 as part of Faith Explored. And then we're going to be following that up with a discussion, a debate on Unbelievable on the Shroud of Turin. So if you're listening out for that between 2.30 and 4, or indeed downloading it via the podcast, what you'll hear is Alan Wanger, who is one of the foremost experts in the world on the Turin Shroud, and he'll be explaining why he does believe it is indeed the burial cloth of Christ and evidence for the resurrection. And then on the other side, Hugh Ferry. Now, he's from the British Society of the Turin Shroud, but he himself is a sceptic as far as it being a real object from the first century. So you'll be hearing why overall he doesn't believe, despite believing it's an extraordinary object in itself, he doesn't believe it is what Alan believes it is. So if you've never really looked into the evidence for the Turin Shroud, as I discovered, there's an interesting, a huge amount of stuff out there on it. And I guess I approached this whole area a year or more ago when I started looking into it as someone who thought it was rather esoteric, sort of endeavor, not really thinking it had much value for Christian apologetics. Well, I was wrong. I think there's some really interesting arguments for whether this could be a genuine piece of evidence for Jesus and the resurrection. So look out for that at the same time next week when Alan Wanger and Hugh Ferry will be joining me on Unbelievable. Okay, so lots to look forward to. Also, your thoughts on the last couple of weeks of programming. We'll be getting to those at the end of today's show. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on the program, be delighted to hear from you. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch via Facebook and Twitter at UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to catch up with what's happening on the Facebook page. All those links and more available from the Unbelievable website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. You can add your comments there to recent shows, and you can find links to where you can download the program as well. Many thousands of people download the program every week via iTunes or other podcasting software, and perhaps you'd like to join them or let a friend know about the program. I know that a lot of people do discover the program because someone told them to go and listen to it. Anyway, however you're listening, it's great to have you with me this Saturday afternoon. Let's finish up this discussion on Adam and Eve.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So finally wrapping up our conversation on whether we've been misreading the Adam and Eve story. My guests John Walton and Steve Lloyd with me as we sort of finish up today's discussion. The Lost World of Adam and Eve, John, you said right at the beginning that Genesis is written for us but not to us. And this is something you've wanted to be really clear about, is that as far as you're concerned, you're simply trying to read it for what it is and for what it was written as, without kind of too many other preconceptions coming in.
Right. It's so difficult to set aside our modern ways of thinking. And anachronism is so simple for us to think that everybody thinks the same way that we do. And so this idea that we have to try to penetrate the ancient world and understand it. It's a very difficult thing. It's not just a matter of reading one or two or three Babylonian Egyptian creation texts. This is about penetrating deeply beneath their literature and trying to understand as best we can how they think. This is not psychoanalysis. It's really saying the literature can be a window into that world, and we're going to try to look in all the windows and try to understand that world as best we can.
I mean, one question that I can imagine comes up for some people is, well, does this mean that if you're not a scholar of the Bible, or you know, or you're not used to reading it at an academic level, that you'll never really understand what the Genesis story is about if you just sat down and read it for yourself without access to your books or other books?
Well, of course, if they don't know Hebrew, they're not reading it for themselves. They're reading what someone else's translation is, so they're already dependent on scholars who have packaged the information for them. Mm. And we don't just have to package linguistic information, Hebrew to English. We also have to package cultural information. They're related, and both are important. So the general message, the overall theology, the basic idea of the text is accessible to everyone. But the details, yes, there are things that are very difficult to get at and that even the experts disagree on.
Indeed, as we've been hearing today.
And it's interesting what John was saying earlier about that he doesn't start with the New Testament when he's trying to interpret these things about origins. And in a way, I think that is a key difference between us. And to me, the answer to how we deal with all of this stuff about understanding ancient Near East way of thinking is precisely to go back to the New Testament. They are closer to it than we are. They were in an Israelite culture. And also, they were apostles. So we have apostolic authority on how they interpreted Genesis. And surely that has to be our starting point.
Well, I would disagree with you on at least the first one and to some extent on the second one. That is, they are part of the Hellenistic, Greco-Roman world, which is way different than the ancient Near East. Between the 1-2 punch of Persian culture and then Hellenistic culture, the ancient world was lost, and the New Testament folks are no longer thinking in ancient Near Eastern terms. That's why it was lost. That's why it's a lost world, and why we have to go back to the ancient Near Eastern texts that were excavated in the last 150 years, over 1 million of them, to try to get to that information. Secondly, of course, apostolic authority is important, but the apostles are no more authoritative than Moses or David or writers in the Old Testament would be. And we need to make sure we get the authority of those Old Testament authors. The New Testament authors are adding their own authoritative voice, and we need to take them as that way, but that doesn't necessarily override what the Old Testament voices were saying. So we have to be very careful, I believe, as we maneuver through this authority issue.
Mm. You wanted to bring up, I think, something about, Steve, while John doesn't have a bone to pick with the science in this case, you know, he's just wanting to look at the text in its context, if you like. You do believe he at some level brings those kinds of concerns into the book?
I mean, for example, on page 154, he talks about the anthropological evidence for violence in the earliest populations deemed human would indicate that there was never a time when sinful behaviour was not present. And I think that is colouring the way that he is then interpreting the text. He's seeing that as, if you like, a sort of a fact, and therefore it's not a problem to see sin as being present right at the beginning in Genesis.
And I don't think that's a fact that I've heard anyone disagree with. I'm just trying to take account of what appears to be a scientific consensus and say, and that's how this would fit in the interpretation I'm taking.
Well, it's interesting, because I wouldn't dispute there's anthropological evidence for violence, but I would say that is actually in a post-flood world, and it actually brings us on to the science issues, because when we're digging up hominid fossils and things, it's actually got nothing to do with Adam at all. It's all about what was going on in the world after the flood, how the human population was spreading out across the world, how it was probably rather more varied than it is today. So actually what you think about the flood and other issues has a massive impact on how you're going to interpret the scientific evidence. And one of the reasons why I'm not so troubled by some of the genetic evidence and things that is presented as being a problem for my position is that, in my view, no one has actually tested a biblical model. to me, a biblical model has to include Adam living at 930 years, which I noticed something that, John doesn't mention at all anywhere in the book, which is quite strange for a book on Adam. But that is part of what we need to take into account with Adam, and also the fact that the entire population was wiped out with the flood. You've got to include all those things if you're going to start testing a model and then saying whether science disagrees with what the Bible is saying. You've actually got to test a biblical model to make that judgment.
And you're absolutely right. It does involve opinions of the flood and opinions about the genealogies, and I suspect you and I would disagree on some of those as well. Again, I wasn't trying to fold the Bible into a scientific view. I was only talking about, given those who have accepted that scientific view, here's how this biblical information would work.
Yeah, so you're saying if you take that as read, then here's a way in which
right.
it could sit alongside it. I mean,
exactly.
You know, obviously Genesis does not consist just in 1, 2 and 3. Do you plan the Lost World of Noah? What's next in the Lost World series, John?
I really wasn't planning on doing any more Lost World books. I think there is a Lost World of the Flood, but I'm not sure that I've found anything to help us situate ourselves. Should I get to that point, and some people would like to see a Lost World of the Flood book, I don't know. But at this point, it's not in the plan.
Okay. Well, look, it's been really interesting having you both on, and obviously very different perspectives on Genesis, but a really interesting interaction on it. And really appreciate you both taking the time to be with me on the program today. Anything you'd like to say just as we close out, John?
Well, again, I would just like to affirm how important it is to read the Bible as faithfully as we can. Traditional interpretations have always been trying to do that. But we need to continue that process because there's always new things to be seen in our analysis of the biblical text. And it's important for us to engage in faithful reading, and I'm trying to do that as best I can. I'm sure others are as well.
Indeed. In that sense, we're all trying to be faithful. I mean, I don't think you would doubt that John is trying to be faithful in that sense, Steve. But you've obviously come
Indeed.
To very different conclusions.
But I think it does actually change the biblical story. And just very simply, to me, the most obvious way that is done is if death was there right at the beginning, then when Jesus comes in his resurrection to conquer death, he's conquering an enemy he made at the beginning. And that, to me, just makes a nonsense of the Bible story. And it also matters for our apologetics. People in this country have been quite exercised by a little clip that Stephen Fry produced a few weeks ago, talking about the sort of suffering in the world. And if it's a God that made that, what sort of a monster is he? And I don't see we've got any way of answering his objections with actually the sort of position that John is coming from. But John is in company with many others that take a very similar view.
We are going to have to draw it to a close there. But thank you very much. And links to John's book, if you want it, from the website of the show under today's episode. So that's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. The Lost World of Adam and Eve, published by IVP. Steve, if you want to find out more about him, go to Biblical Creation Ministries, and links to both Steve and John from today's website. Great to have you both on, gentlemen. Thanks for being with me today.
Thank you.
Great to be on.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks to all those who have been in touch about recent programmes. And again, if you want to get in touch, then do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be happy to read out your emails in forthcoming editions of the programme. Or indeed, let me know via Twitter and Facebook what you thought as well. @unbelievablejb, my Twitter handle. facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow via the Facebook page. Let's talk, before we go into some of your comments on recent shows, about the Unbelievable Conference, which isn't happening this year. And I keep getting questions from people saying, is there a conference this year, Justin? No, we've decided to postpone the conference for this year. We'll be coming back bigger and better in 2016, though. We can assure you of that. So look out for more about that in due course. But first of all, just a couple of people who wanted to talk about the ontological argument. Remember that a few weeks ago? Peter S. Williams and Peter Millikan debating the ontological argument. Can you effectively define God into existence? Here's Darren, a skeptic, who says, OK, I loved your skeptic. Finally, someone pointing out where all the made-up concepts are coming in, as well as pointing out the obvious contradictions of the different apologetics. I was going to do an email about all the made-up parts of the argument that make this argument rather silly, but you nailed it on the head when you pointed out you can't just define or imagine something into existence. Well, I don't know if I quite made that case, but perhaps... Yes, Peter Millican perhaps said something along those lines. But thanks, Darren, getting in touch. Ben in Rochester, Michigan said, I was remiss in writing to you following the programme on the ontological argument. These are two of your best guests on both sides of the table. There are a few others who could have so intensely and knowledgeably have conducted such an arcane debate and kept it both respectful and enjoyable to listen to. It's not hard to imagine them laughing about it over a pint afterwards. Thanks for tackling such a difficult topic that I've continued to try to understand and still do. Thanks very much. Yes, it was one of those brain-bending shows, the ontological argument debate, wasn't it? We did something a bit different the week after when we had a panel of young apologists taking a variety of sceptical questions. So we'll come to some of the feedback on that, been quite a lot on that. Firstly, though, let's look at this one from Tyler, who says, I'm an American atheist who's been listening to your show for years now. Every week, my wife and I listen to the podcast as soon as it becomes available. One of the questions that never gets addressed and is becoming a frustration of mine is, what does it mean to make a cumulative case for God? Seems to me that the phrase is used to get around one of the oldest debates in recorded history. How many gods are there? I guess you wouldn't have to call them gods. You could just call them supernatural beings. Does the phrase a cumulative case for God really eliminate the possibility that the universe was created by one God and the morals by another? Couldn't all of the arguments for God really just point to a pantheon of supernatural beings that may not ever exist anymore? At this point, I assume Occam's razor might come to mind, but I'm not sure if this is the card that Christians want to play, given the number of supernatural beings that they actually believe in. Wouldn't a God that has only one part to the Godhead be more parsimonious than the Trinitarian God? What about the devil, angels, and the rest of the demons? Certainly, Occam's razor would do a number of orthodox would do... Certainly, Occam's razor would do a number on Orthodox Christianity if it was applied consistently. Moreover, Occam's razor is a preference, not a requirement. In sum, perhaps you could do a show defending the use of the cumulative argument approach, or a show that puts polytheism against monotheism. Whatever you do, please continue to make this amazing programme. It just may be my favourite programme, period. Thank you, Tyler. That's a lovely thing to say. I guess what your suggestion boils down to is, when we talk about a cumulative case for God, we're talking about, I suppose, a multiplicity of arguments, all of which together provide a so-called cumulative case for the existence of God. And you say, well, couldn't it equally be a cumulative case for a whole number of supernatural beings? You know, why does it have to be one God? I think that probably most of the classical arguments for theism do tend to assume or have at their conclusion a monotheistic outcome, because they define God in that way, as being the most powerful or moral or whatever it may be. The attributes seem to require that there be a single entity in that sense, because having more than one would make it difficult to say that they are the most powerful in some sense. But it's an interesting question that you put there. Perhaps one thing we could do in terms of devils, angels and the rest of the demons and so on. I mean, obviously, that's, if you like, the Christian worldview would say that's the part of the created order. So none of those things are, in any sense, a rival to God. They are simply just as the creation is the physical, natural creation, they are part of the supernatural world that God has created. But the whole thing about whether the Trinity means that there's more than one God, obviously, most Christian theologians would disagree with you on that and say that's not at all what it means. But thank you for the email. I tell you, I've had far more emails from atheists this week than from Christians. It's interesting, isn't it? Let's talk about some of the response to that show where I had a number of young apologists join me, some of them representing the UK Apologetics Facebook network and blog. And I lined up a number of callers from around the world, skeptics who listened to the show and wanted to come on to ask a few questions. We took quite a variety of topics for that. And what I'll do is I'll start on here. We won't get through all of these by any means, but we'll give it a start, and I'll continue to read out some of it on next week's show when we get to the feedback section. Tian Han Kam said, "I can't help scratching my head when one of your sceptical guests, Ben, claimed that he lost his faith due to the vast evidence against Christianity. I suspect the vast evidence that he spoke of were evolution theory-related ones." Because, well, he did reference that, I suppose, in his introduction. "I'd like to encourage him to reinvestigate those evidences and start questioning the assumptions and interpretations behind that evidence in the light of observational and repeatability, as in real scientific approach to any problem. Here's an article that may help him to understand the differences between historical and observational science." You've linked there to an Answers in Genesis website. "It amazes me to see how evolutionists, believing in impossibilities while ignoring any evidence that points to a young Earth," and you say, "it reminds you of Romans 1:20-21, they're without excuse." Well, got to confess, I am in the same camp in that sense, Tian. I don't believe in a young Earth myself. So I don't think, to be honest, that for me is personally a good application of Romans 1:20. But anyway, appreciate that that's the perspective you take on the issue. Here's another one who comes in response to Ben on a similar level. Philip Raymond in Melbourne says, "I was intrigued that Ben wanted evidence for God at least as good as that for evolution. That is, I'm intrigued that he set the bar so low, given the paucity of real evidence for evolution. After all, they can't even find the fossil evidence for the fine gradation of intermediate fossils that Darwin predicted, nor for the origin of the truly novel genetic information that evolution needs. Essentially, all evolution is supposed to have occurred in the past, when there was no scientist there to observe it, whilst the evidence for God has been attested to by many witnesses who saw God the Son while he was on the earth. The evidence for God is much stronger." Now, you go on to say other things. Tim, on the show, made some claims about Australian Christians, mentioning Melbourne in particular. He said that many of them were motivated by fear and therefore cut themselves off from others. He also claimed that Melbourne famously has a church on every second corner and a pub on every first corner, and it and Australia were mainly Christian places. "Well, as a long-time resident of Melbourne, I reject pretty well everything," he said. "I've never heard that bit about churches and pubs. Melbourne's no more Christian than most other places in Australia, perhaps even less so. And neither Australia nor Melbourne is a mainly Christian place, if you count those who bother going to church, as opposed to those who might nominate Christian on the census." Okay, not dissimilar in that sense to the UK, which you could describe, you know, on the basis of some polls and censuses as a Christian nation. But I think what you really need to look at is the level of committed church going to really get an idea of who's really committed. Anyway, thank you very much. Ian Mackey, "An excellent show. I must admit, I wasn't looking forward to it, thinking it would just be the usual kind of questions, but the questions were really good and interesting. Well done for setting up the programme, and well done to the atheists and agnostics for having the questions." And here's another one from Jason in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. "One of the apologists you had on your show gave an answer to a question regarding the proof of God's existence that I think is nonsensical, and I've heard it offered so many times. She said that God doesn't reveal himself to people because he doesn't want to force a relationship on anyone. Well, what about the people he supposedly revealed himself to already? Does that mean that he forced himself on those people? The other problem I'd like to illustrate with a quick Superman analogy. I love Superman, but I think he's imaginary. I would love to have a friendship with Superman, but I don't even have the option to accept or reject a relationship with him unless he reveals his existence to me first. If Superman is real, though, and he never reveals his existence to me, then he's rejecting me, not the other way around. How unkind it would be of him, then, if my eternal well-being depended upon having a friendship with him. I hope this illuminates some of the reasons why this apologetic is so weak. Can we please put this lame apologetic excuse to rest?" Love the show, by the way. Thanks, Jason. Yeah, well, look, I think one or two responses that I'd give to that, which is firstly, I think Superman and God are fairly fundamentally different. Obviously, you think God is as imaginary as Superman, but the reality is there aren't that many people in the world who would try to convince you of the existence of Superman, whereas obviously there's millions of people in the world who do believe in the existence of God and that there are good reasons to believe in God. So there's a bit of a difference there. And in that sense, you know, perhaps we need to give a little bit more credence to the exploration of whether belief in God is rational as opposed to belief in Superman. But beyond that, I think there personally there is something in the argument that it would be somehow wrong for God to give us overwhelming proof of his existence, in as much as it may not simply be God's desire to have people believe in him. You know, in that sense, he could do that with a snap of his fingers, get everyone to believe in him. It's more for me the fact that God wants people to trust him and to have faith in him, and in that sense, to have a relationship with him. And in that sense, making everyone believe in him by forcing his existence upon them would, in a sense, be taking something of that free will that's involved in a love relationship. I know that probably sounds like, you know, the biggest get out clause you can get when it comes to apologetics, but I'm convinced that belief in God is in some important way not simply something we do in our head. It's something that happens in the heart. Now, Unbelievable, obviously, and most apologetics tends to deal with the head issues and not the heart issues. I believe that whenever God does reveal himself to someone in that sense, it's a combination of the head and the heart. And it's not a kind of the type of revelation that cannot be rejected, if you like. I think people can always choose to reject God if they want to, for a kind of variety of reasons. Anyway, it's a fascinating area. One, maybe we should do a proper show on at some point. But appreciate you getting in touch. About out of time here, and loads more responses that I wanted to do on that. So we'll do some more same time next week. For the moment, let me tell you what's coming up on next week's programme. You're unbelievable. Could the Turin Shroud, which is going back on display this April in the city of Turin, could it be the burial cloth of Jesus Christ? Does it date from the first century, or is it a medieval fake? Well, we're going to be debating all the ins and outs of the Turin Shroud, one of the most scientifically tested objects in the world, next week on the programme. My special guest, Alan Wanger, who is what you might call a devoted believer in the Shroud and its authenticity, and Hugh Ferry, who is an anti-authenticist. So do join us for that at the same time, same place, next week. In the meantime, I hope you've enjoyed today's programme. Do join me again in a moment's time as I'm joined by Paula Gooder for The Profile.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.